This is the Music Talk Atari 8-Bit Podcast.
This episode, an interview with John Henson, who was editor-in-chief and chief designer of the New Aladdin magazine. Maybe you haven't heard of the New Aladdin magazine. I will tell you about it. It was one of the first floppy disk-based magazines, definitely the first disk magazine that was geared towards a general audience as opposed to being a magazine for computer people. It was published for the Atari 8-bit machines, for the Atari ST, and also for the Amiga. They only published a few issues, but they were doing something new, and they managed to spend more than $1 million to create and launch this product. I'm going to read to you the little article about the launch of the New Aladdin in Newsbyte's News Network, which was published on June 2nd, 1987. It says, "The New Aladdin is a magazine on a disk. Dallas. After a year of test runs, The New Aladdin, a magazine on floppy disk, has begun regular publication with an initial circulation of about 1,000. Editor-in-chief John Henson told Newsbytes, "There are 20 articles in each issue. They're all exclusive, all original. It comes out about every 2 months." He described the content this way: "We're producing a general interest, interactive, family-oriented publication. We have short stories from science fiction to mystery to humor. We have games in it, general interest articles, and science articles. Yes, they pay for freelance contributions. To use the New Aladdin, all you need to know about a computer is how to turn it on," Henson says. Now for the gritty details. Currently, the New Aladdin is out in an 8-bit version for the Atari home computers and 16-bit versions for the Amiga and the Atari ST. A version for the Apple IIgs is planned. Versions for the IBM PC and compatibles are expected down the road. So that's the article in Newsbytes. Spoiler alert, the 2GS and IBM PC versions never came out. But several editions did for the Atari 8-bit, all of which are available. I archived them and made them available, and there will be a link in the show notes at ataripodcast.com to a forum post on Atari Age where you can download them all to your emulator. They're worth seeing. There's some great graphics in there. Even if you don't want to read the articles, they really outdid themselves with the graphics, I think, and they're interesting to look at, nice-looking magazines. So here is the interview with John Henson, editor-in-chief of the New Aladdin magazine.
So you were the editor of the New Aladdin, is that right?
Yes. I concepted the magazine and was the editor-in-chief in it, and also the principal designer.
The principal what?
Designer.
Principal designer. Okay, excellent. All right, well, I'm going to tell you what I know about it, and then I would like to tell you to tell me what you know about it. So, I only discovered that I'm an Atari 8-bit person, and you know, I co-host a podcast about Atari 8-bit stuff, and I was going through my basement. I've got all these floppy disks that I've collected over the years, and I discovered the New Aladdin just a few days ago. I have several issues. Honestly, I don't know how I acquired them, and I had never seen this magazine before. But I'm really intrigued by it, so I've looked at all of them, and I asked around in the Atari forum about it, and there's not a lot of information about it. It seems like of the people who are still using Ataris, you know, not a lot of them are really familiar with it. So I was sharing screenshots and things. So I'd like you to tell me about how it came to exist and how you were involved, and just tell me everything, please.
Okay. It's such a peculiar story, it might be a little too long.
I got
friend
that.
And I'm basically a theater designer. At least that's been my occupation, that an actor, a director, and a playwright. And friend of mine who was on the board of directors of the theater that I was working in at the time, decided we wanted to start a new company. And what we were intrigued with was image manipulation. And at that time, Newsweek and various other magazines was using these intricate covers where, you know, their headline went behind the head of somebody, and then there were stories about these ability for them to take people out of one situation, put them in another situation. And we started looking at that, and the systems that they were using to do those things were something called a SpyTex, which was actually a Hewlett-Packard company that or computer that was then shipped to Israel, and they made modifications in it and did their own software and then sent them back to wherever they were selling it. And these things were hideously expensive, in the $1 million range. And as we pursued looking at this, I decided that the Macintosh was right on the verge of being able to take over this entire industry for a fraction of the price. So we stopped looking at that and started looking for something else, and I came up with the idea of doing a magazine on disk. And at the time, I had an Atari 800 and an Atari ST, and actually also had an Amiga. So we came down to the idea that we'll produce this magazine for these three systems. And so I put together a staff of people that could do it. Mainly from a creative side, it was from news and publishing, and from the technical side, it was mostly Atari people. And we started working on it, and we were in business for about 3 years. When we started looking for other investment to promote it, because we had to do a development stage that lasted almost a year before we got any product out the door. And when we went around looking for investment, nobody could fathom what it was we were doing. At that
right.
time, it was back in 1968, I think. And the issue that you or the issues that you have, are they ST or 800?
I have four issues for the 800. Actually, I do have a couple of ST issues here, but I haven't looked at them because I'm not an ST person.
Okay, well, so, if you look at them, you'll find out that we were able to do some trickery with the computer that made it look exactly as if it were running on an Amiga. And if you knew the difference between the ST and the ST had a lot of power in other areas where the Amiga didn't, but the Amiga had a lot more visual power.
Mm-hmm.
It could be more colors in a higher resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to do some interrupts and a few other things that got us into a situation where our resolution was as high as the Amiga and with the same number of colors.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of blew Atari clubs, anyway, blew their minds how we were doing this. And the truth of the matter is, it was more like a magician than like a programmer, because we were taking some stuff that made it look like we were doing one thing when in fact we weren't. And the reason we didn't is because it was impossible to do. And but they never caught on to what we were doing, so it looked like we were performing a miracle. You know, and it was kind of kicky when we go out to clubs. And that's one of the ways we were promoting the thing. We were traveling all over the nation promoting it at computer clubs.
Hmm.
Anyway, we got the thing going, and then we started looking for this extra. Our principal investor at the beginning of the thing spent a little more than $1 million on the development of the product and getting
wow.
it out. But we went out looking for more money, and we went to people like Ross Perot, who we had a contact with, and he looked at it, and he's, you know, Mr. Computer of the time, and he looked at it, and he said, "This is brilliant, this is great, but it's 20 years ahead of the time. No, I'm not going to invest in it now." So we said, "Thank you, but we think you're crazy," and left. Well, we could not find investors who were willing to take the risk at that time, because the way we were shipping it, we're on diskettes. And at that time, there was no internet, or there was a nascent sort of internet, but it was not enough. Nobody knew about it. Nobody had anything in it. So, and everybody wanted to know, well, why aren't you on the IBM PC? Well, the IBM PC had no resolution and only had four colors at most. I mean, that's the way it was. And very few people actually had them in their homes. Well, this product was designed for the house. It was not designed for the office. And so the perfect machines for it were the Ataris and the Amigas.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able, through our contacts, to get prominent people to develop content for it. I don't know if you've noticed, but there was a Hollywood section that was written by Chantal Westerman of Good Morning America.
Mm-hmm.
And we published a lot of really top-notch writers, like Robert Flynn, who's becoming the new Larry McMurtry. And we were one of the ones that first published them. And there were all kinds of things. Like one of the stories that we did in it, we got five different authors to write the same story. And one of the authors wrote the introductory paragraph to it and the closing paragraph to it, which all the other authors had to use. We also gave them an opening line for the next for each of the following paragraphs and a closing line. But whatever they wanted to write in between those two lines, they could do whatever they wanted. It's just that it always had to enter at the same point and exit at the same point.
So you had a story, a story outline, and everyone is more or less writing the same story, but they can take it in their own direction.
Yes. They could take it in any direction they wanted to, as long as each of the paragraphs entered with that same sentence and exited with the same sentence. And they both had, all of them had to use the opening paragraph and the ending paragraph.
Okay.
And then when you got it on your computer, the computer, each time you looked at it, would randomly assemble the authors. So, I don't want to get into how many variations of stories there were, but it was over 365,000 or something stories, unique stories that could have been generated out of this product. Most of them would all sound similar, but they were different writers from all over the country. I mean, somebody was out of New York, another person was out of Hollywood, another person was out of Texas, and it was adventure, I would say that.
So it seems like you were trying to create a new kind of, really experimenting with the medium.
Yes. What we wanted to do, we wanted to produce a magazine for the general consumer, not for the computerist.
Mm-hmm.
We did have articles in the magazine for people who were computer-oriented, but it wasn't a technical magazine, and there was nothing else like this at the time. Nothing. We were way ahead of ourselves, I guess.
Now, Ross Perot was right, huh?
Huh?
Ross Perot was right. You were ahead of your time.
Yeah, he was right. I hate to say that, but he was right. We were. Now is the time for this because, you know, people are already doing it. They are doing this sort of thing. But,
right.
Like I said, it was a general interest magazine, and it had full family value. There was things in it for children. There was things in it for adults. There were things for women, things for men. Then there were things for people who were interested in computers. Mm-hmm. But our point was, people have these machines in their homes. They're using them to play games mostly at that time. And so why not use it to have a different form of entertainment? We did movie reviews. We got stills from the studios. Those were published, and even though they were frequently in black and white, the resolution of the images were much better than anybody else had going on the computer at that time, and it was pretty mind-boggling at that time. It wouldn't be now, but it was then. And we got written up in Newsweek. Omni magazine was really big at that time, and they wrote us up in it. And there was a company in Europe who did a European science magazine, kind of like Omni, but it was another one. They published it in 5 different languages. Well, they sent a team of 6 people over here, and they stayed with us for a week, just covering all the things that we were doing and how we were doing them, whatever. They went back and wrote stories, which were, I hate to say, pretty naive, because they never did understand digitization. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of amusing. But anyway, we stayed in the process long enough to get a number of issues out. We were selling them in subscription. We had subscribers all over the world. We had people in Saudi Arabia, in New Zealand, Australia, Canada, England, lots of European countries, and across the United States. But what happened, we also were trying, people in the Soviet Union were trying to get it from us, and of course we couldn't sell it to them, even though our technology was that of an Atari or an Amiga. We still fell under the Technology Restriction Acts to foreign countries that were not agreeable to us. So
sure.
we were not allowed to sell them, but I can't tell you how many people we had from the European bloc of Soviet countries trying to get the product from us.
Do you know how many subscribers you had?
By the time we closed?
Yeah.
I think we probably had somewhere in the area of about 2,000.
2,000?
2,000, yeah. But, you know, that was pretty remarkable considering the limitation of our ability to spend money on advertising. We just did not advertise. We did everything through public relations. And to have gotten that worldwide was pretty remarkable.
Was the content more or less the same across the machines, the articles and that sort of thing?
They were all the same, and except in the technology area where we would focus on something for each of the 3 machines.
How large was the staff?
We had one ST programmer, one 800 programmer, and one Amiga programmer. We had 3 visuals people working in the arts, graphics, and what have you, and 3 editors, including myself.
It's a good size.
And one marketing person. That person's job was to go out frequently to make presentations and what have you around the country, trade shows and things like that.
Do you know how many issues were published altogether? About?
Honestly, I can't remember. I think they probably were 5 for the ST and maybe 5 for the 800 and probably 4 or 5 for the ST and the Amiga. We didn't do it on a regular schedule. That was one of the problems. We were supposed to do it bi-monthly, in other words, every 2 months was what we had set up for. And there were times when we didn't make it on 2 months schedule. We had to wait until the 3rd month to get it out. But as far as I know, no one complained.
I found an article in Newsbytes announcing the magazine, and it said, I just kind of want to verify what actually happened here. It said it was out for the Atari 8-bit and Amiga and ST, and it said a version for the Apple IIgs is planned, and for the IBM PC is expected down the road. Did the Apple IIgs or the PC version ever happen?
No, and neither did the IBM PC. We had planned to do them, but by the time we got around to doing it, the IIgs was considered a failure for Apple. That was when Jobs was not there, and company mm-hmm. was being run by the guy from Texaco or whatever. PC still wasn't up to par, mm-hmm. and we were really trying to figure out what we were going to do to get it into that so that and by up to par, I don't mean that the machine couldn't perform the operation perform, I mean to present it.
I mean in terms of graphic and sound and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the shortened graphic capability, but it was still not in people's homes.
Right.
And if it was Daddy doing work at home from his office, it wasn't the family using it. I mean,
right.
Again, thinking about when this was. I urge you to try to get hold of an ST version and look at it, or an ST to try to look at it, because it and the Amiga versions obviously were, because of their resolution and color capability, were much more conducive to producing something that somebody really wanted. Although I will admit we got a great response from the 8-bit community. I mean, 8-bit, Atari 8.
The 8-bit version is the one I've seen, and the graphics are amazing on it. Anyone could really tell that you guys put time into making it look as great as you could.
Yeah, and again, keep in mind, digitizing software and hardware was terrible at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was all sort of like, stuff that people got in stores to do things around their house because they were tinkerers, and they played with it, but it was nothing serious. And again, we had to, we had a large staff, and it was a creative staff, and we had to pay them. And we were trying to get product out the door so that we could get investment in. And we didn't have money to spend on really, truly very high-end equipment. It's possible we could have found digitizing equipment that could have gotten converted for us by spending $100,000 on something, but we didn't have that step.
Mm-hmm. All right.
One of the best articles on us was in Southwest Airlines In Flight magazine, Spirit. And it was a multi-page article with color pictures and everything in it that was very well done. And you can get a copy of that. It had a lot of information in it.
Awesome. Cool. So eventually, I assume they decided they shut down the publication because it was not making money?
Yeah. When we ran out of money, the investors shut us down.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to shut it down. We wanted it going. And
sure.
Felt that we could had we been able to stay there. But
Do you still have any of the discs around?
Yes, I think I have a couple of them that I've kept as just, hopefully someday they might have some value to a museum or something, but I doubt it. But yes, I do have some. I don't have a lot. We pretty much sold all the ones that we manufactured. I think the very first one was in December, and it has a Christmas tree on the front. It's
The first one for the Atari was May 1986. And then the next one was September, and then the third one was October, November, and then the last one for the Atari that I have was the Christmas one.
Is it, and it's got the Christmas tree on it? Okay,
yeah.
I'm remembering. This is a long time ago, and believe me, I have not thought about this in a long time. I've gone
sure.
on to do other things. After we did this particular product, we Peter and I stayed in business with each other, and we created a product called Dallas Views, which was a video magazine that ran in hotels. And we were planning on running them just in Dallas hotels as a experiment. Mm-hmm. And then we started expanding them out. But we discovered that the hotels at that particular time had a rather bizarre attitude about stuff. They wanted everybody in the hotel kept in the hotel.
Sure.
You know, so they did not want us doing any ads or promotionals in the magazine for, like, restaurants in town. And that was how we were going to be generating, because we were putting the equipment into the hotels free to run all this stuff. And they sort of killed it because they didn't want us advertising anything that wasn't happening in the hotel itself.
Because if you're not spending money in the hotel, then you're not helping the hotel, right?
Yeah. So we killed that because it wasn't going to be prosperous under those conditions. And then he went into another area and moved out of town and has since passed away, unfortunately. But I went on to start a company called Castleworks Gameware, which produced games for the IBM PC. And we did that for about a year and a half. And then a friend of mine in a theater was having severe problems. She needed help, so I dropped out of that and went and helped her and stayed with it for the next 16 years. Now I'm starting a whole new business, which is Nuvo Libre, which is where you sent your email.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you looked it up to see what it was, but it is, but it's a publishing company for the iBook, the Macintosh iBook, or Apple iBook, I should say.
So you're still on the cutting edge of publishing?
Yes, it is. And it's really cutting edge in this case because it's doing things inside novels and books that are interactive. So
all right, I think I just have two more questions. Well, first of all, I mean, is there anything, any other interesting things I and my listeners should know about the new Aladdin before that we haven't talked about?
Well, no, other than. Personally, I don't think it was ahead of its time. I mean, yes, we were pushing the technology, but the delivery system was not as good as it could have been. And that's unfortunate. But it could have been successful. I'm sorry. I thought that the Atari product, especially the Bushnell one, the 800, was a brilliant piece of work. And I guess the only thing I've left out of this is how I got involved with the Atari computer in the first place. And that was, I was designing a play for the Dallas Theater Center, which is one of the top five regional theaters in America. And it was a new play. It was called On the Walk, and it had to do with off-track betting.
Okay.
You know, the whole play took place in this betting parlor. And I had to have monitors up on the stage where, you know, they were showing what was happening on the track and all of the various stuff. Well, there was no software out there that I could get hold of to display this stuff on these images, and the audience had to see it. And somebody said, well, you'll have to get somebody who knows how to program a computer to write special material for this. And I said, well, that'll cost way too much money. I can't afford that in my set budget. So,
okay. So this would be like a display that the audience would see to visualize what was happening on the horse track.
Not on the actual horse track, in the betting parlor, about where, you know, what's happening on the screen.
Okay.
It shows you statistically what was happening at the track. And
okay.
Whether your point was going up or down or whatever, how it would resolve itself. Which horse was in the lead, which and whatever. And it had to be real time against what the actors were doing on stage. Which was difficult.
So did you end up programming this?
I ended up, I said, well, I guess what I'll do is I'll just get a computer, and in my naive day, I said, I'll just buy a computer and I'll program it myself. And never having had any programming experience whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And turned out that at that time, Neiman Marcus was selling the Atari 800. That's how revolutionary and upset it was. And so I, having a Neiman Marcus card, went over and charged it and bought a computer and got it home and then noticed that there was this cartridge, the basic cartridge, was there. And so I sat down with the book and taught myself to program it, and I did the thing, and I got it up there, and it was great.
Cool.
But anyway, by the time I was finished with that, a friend of mine who worked at TI kept telling me, you really ought to be a programmer. You really ought to be a programmer. And I kept saying, I'm not interested in programming. I'm only interested in playing games.
Mm-hmm.
And he has since chortled a lot because, I have been involved in the technical side of developing product now for quite a few years.
So to clarify on the play about off-track betting, was this like interactive with the audience?
It wasn't interactive, but I mean the actors were up on stage and the monitors could be seen by the audience. They had to be seen.
Right.
And so when the actors reacted with the monitor, the audience had to see the action of the monitor with the actor.
I see. Okay.
And this was not an easy thing to find out because, actors are human and they're not machines, and so they don't do everything at the same time.
Right.
But we got them to stay pretty close to it, and it worked.
And what was the name of this play?
I believe the name of it was Off the Street. It was done during a play festival, so it was. I don't know if the play has ever gone on and been done anywhere else or not. Probably it hasn't because it was too hard to get that effect.
Right. I think that's... my last question, I think, is the name New Aladdin. What does that mean?
I wondered if you'd ask. this was the theory behind it, and I think it still holds. You, the person owning the computer, are the New Aladdin. And the computer is Aladdin's lamp. And like in the story of Aladdin and his lamp, when you summon the genie and ask it to do something, it does exactly what you ask it to do, but not necessarily what you want.
Right.
And as a result, we were trying to make the point that if you're going to have a computer, you're going to have to know how to communicate with it. Otherwise, you're like Aladdin, and you get a genie who does something you think you want, but it's something that you asked for, not what you really wanted.
Right. Okay. Good answer.
That's how that evolved.
That's, I like that. Last thing, if you could send a message to the Atari 800 community that still exists, and you can right now, what would you tell them?
Well, I have in a warehouse a bunch of equipment if anybody wants to buy any of it. And, you know, this is talking about Nolan Bushnell now, because I thought he was, and still is to some degree, one of the more brilliant minds in the computing industry. He created something that left quite a legacy for the general consumer, because, you know, Steve Jobs worked for him. And out of what happened with Atari, that's how Jobs concepted the Apple Macintosh, and ultimately led to that. And I think the Atari community has always been on the cutting edge of what I would call computer creativity. And I was really, really sorry to see that Jack Tramiel took over Atari in his infinite greed. So I wish everyone well, for sure, and admire them all for having stayed with it.
Awesome. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Certainly. If you do use this at any point, I'd love to know when it's going to be on your site and or how you're using it.
There's going to be an episode, I suspect, that will be out late this month or early in October. That's going to be an all-interview episode, and you will be in it. And I will send you a link to that once I've done it.
All right.
All right?
Yeah, that'll be a great birthday present for me, because my birthday is October the 5th.
Excellent. Happy birthday. How old are you going to be, if I may ask?
71.
Great. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.